Oscar, Tampa Tommy, come on down. You're the host of the Insurgent Radio Network, broadcasting live from the bunker in North Central Indiana, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern, where the elite meet to eat, but mostly drink. Also nearby is Terrible Tommy's Weapons of Mass Destruction Used Equipment Yard, where you can purchase a freshly refurbished weapon of mass destruction for pennies on the dollar, if the price is right. You can reach Tom at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Address your letters and mail to Tom Metzger, the Insurgent, just plain old box holder. Good old Tommy O'Gates.
Good morning, good afternoon, wherever you are, ships at sea, around the world, Terrible Tommy here at the microphone. Yeah, P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. It's a beautiful day here on the 15th of July in the Heartland. It's fairly cool. It's supposed to get up to 91, though, today. That's going to be a scorcher. Later this afternoon, I'm going to take my lady. We're going to go to the county fair and listen to some country western music and maybe ride the fair ass wheel. I mean, or something like that, and see all the animals that the kids bring down to the fair and a little bit of everything. So I might even have some. No, I'm not going to do that. I was going to say cotton candy. I do like those ice things, crushed ice with liquid over them. Snowballs or something like that, they call them, I think. I like those. Sure do. Well, I see by the news this morning that in the video they're playing around with that spill down in the Gulf of Mexico. Just a little leak. A spill. It's a gusher. It's an old faithful of oil, man. And I think they're having a little problem there, and now they're suspecting this fissure away from that main oil pipe coming up, which a lot of people have said already that it's already split pipes that are run parallel, evidently, to the bottom. So anyhow, I was listening to a fellow on the radio who's, I don't know, he's off into that little mystical stuff, I guess. But he was talking about 2012, and he said that people have been misreading that, that it's not something going to happen all in one day, bing, bang, bingity, bang. He said 2012 has started already. Look around you at the cataclysmic problems that are facing us. They're already here leading up to 2012. But they're talking, he was talking about the collapse of Western civilization around 2012, whatever that means. But he did talk about traveling with in an area where these shaman are at, way out there. I'm not sure exactly, I forget where he did say, way over there in Asia, I guess, someplace. And they were questioning him and he was questioning them, and he said, ask him, what do you think the main reason for the collapse of Western civilization? And they said, and I thought very perceptibly, that because you don't give reverence to your ancestors. Well, of course, in our case, that's a racial situation. We have forgotten our ancestors. And when you forget your ancestors and don't give them great credit, and even insult them and say bad things about them, you're on your way out. And I thought that was a very interesting comment that these people made. He was quite surprised. I think I have a call just came in from our reporter from the West Coast. Let's see what he's got to say.
Hey, Tom, this is Lomas Cody out here in Northern California. Just thought I'd call and tell you, I talked with a couple of bikers out here who are Hell's Angels, and one guy I met who claims to know your son John, he says in his opinion a lot of bikers and the Hell's Angels in these parts have changed their tune a little bit. A lot of local chapters and stuff will 86 guys for using methamphetamine, and they're changing their tune, and a lot of guys are focusing a little bit more on the racial aspect of the struggle, which I kind of find hard to believe, because I've knew a few Hells Angels when I used to live down here about 7-8 years ago, and they were so far up their ass in methamphetamine as if to be completely useless or worthless to the struggle. But in any ways, that's the word on the street. And as far as I've been able to glean, a lot of guys are moving up to Sonoma County from as far south as San Jose. And they're saying that the Mexicans may take the rest of the state, but they're not going to have the overwhelming majority in Sonoma County. And I find it interesting that, number one, up in Seattle, where I was living for the last 7 years, you find a lot more race-mixed couples up there. You find a lot less down here. I do find a lot of people who are maybe a quarter, eighth, maybe even a 16th, or usually a half mestizo, and then the rest is white. But you find a lot less girls in Northern California walking around with niggers. You don't find as many white guys dating Mexicans. You still have a lot, but it's not quite to the extent that you'd find up in Washington. When Dennis Meehan gave his last report after he visited Washington about a year and a half, 2 years ago, I was a little shocked to hear what he said. At first, I didn't want to believe that he was right about the sheer level of race mixing in Washington State, but having come back down here to California, I can only concur with it. Anyways, that's my report, and I hope the niggers in Oakland burn down the city.
Well, thanks for that report. And any of the other guys out there, what you should do is get on the horn and call 574-267-5036 and give me reports from time to time. Leave it on our phone machine, and I'll put it on the radio show. And it's on Vox, so you can talk quite a while as long as you got something important to say. So anyhow, that's a situation that Cody's looking at out there in California. Well, a lot of the problem with the Hells Angels or any other bike club is they do a lot of drinking, and they do drugs, a lot of them, not all of them. But when you get into drugs and alcohol too much, you start a lot of times any woman comes down the road is fair game to you, and you start thinking with your little brain instead of your big brain. That's the problem there.
I saw you on National Geographic last night. It was good. Good show.
Well, I see we've gotten quite a few emails today and phone calls, because one of the documentaries I did with National Geographic was replayed last night. I forget exactly how that one went, but anyhow, a lot of people seem to like it. We got a couple of bad emails from the Jesus fanatic freaks that are going to have me burning in hell and all that. Isn't that something, you know, that Christians get away with that stuff? I think that any time some preacher or holy roller or priest or rabbi or anybody is within swinging distance and they start telling you how you're going to burn in hell, I think we should knock them flat on their ass, because that's a threat. They want you to die, but they don't want to do it themselves. They want to give it to some mythical person or God or something else to do it to you. But they actually want you, because they don't like what you say and what you believe, to go into a fiery place and burn forever but not burn up. Now, they can jump all over the SS all they want about the Jews, but even the Jews, there was an end to it. I mean, you got a bullet in the back of the head or you got gassed, and that was it. But Christians, they want you to burn forever. Yeah. Talk about a sick bunch of puppies. But I want to tell you, I'm getting more and more in tune with the idea that if one of these religious fanatics starts in on me, a little bit I can take. But when they start talking about, if you don't follow and do what I say, is actually, they'll never admit it's what I say. No, it's what the book, the good book says. Then you're going to go into a fiery place, and I'm all for it, and you're going to be burnt forever, and the fire will never go out. I mean, you know, think about that. think about what they're saying to you, and then knock their teeth out. Yeah.
Hammer. The night was raining. My love, she's like some raven at my window with a broken wing.
Up in the morning, out on a job, worked like the devil for my pay. While that lucky old son got nothing to do but roll around heaven all day. Fuss with my woman, toil for my kids, sweat till I'm wrinkled and gray. While that lucky old son got nothing to do but roll around heaven all day. Good Lord up above, can't you hear me crying tears all in my eyes? Send down that cloud with your silvery lining. Lift me to paradise.
Yeah, baby!
Oh, show me that river.
You're gonna come down the river with that thing!
Take me across. Wash all my troubles away. Like that lucky old son, give me nothing to do but roll around heaven all day. Like that lucky old son, give me nothing to do but roll around heaven all day.
Well, I see nine more states have jumped onto the Arizona illegal alien situation. Of course, a lot of them, it's going to be just for show, you know. Anytime they see a parade, and most of these guys want to get out in front of it. Let's see. I saw who it was. It was Alabama, Florida, Nebraska, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, South Dakota, Texas, and Virginia, as well as Northern Mariana Islands. But I think Indiana's got one up there, but somebody's blocking it. And I'm going to find out who they are and go down there and go around in a small tight circle with those boys at the Indiana State House. Well, here's my funny of the day from my buddy up there in Chicago. Walter. While creating husbands, God promised women that they could find ideal husbands in all corners of the world. And then he made the earth round. I guess this guy saw me on the National Geographic Channel. Well, it's apparent that you're not a Christian. God tells us to love one another as we do ourselves. Well, I do pretty much in my own race. God is all about love. Well, you define love for me, buddy. Most what you call love is nothing but lust. And you and your followers are all about hate. Well, if you don't know how to hate, you don't know how to love, I guess. So what does that tell you? Did you know that Jesus, the Lord's only begotten Son, was not white? Oh, was he a Negro? What will you have to say to him on Judgment Day? I would suggest that you turn or burn. Repent and turn from your sins before it's too late. Read the book of John. Yeah, that boy's upset. Here's another nasty one. I've heard and watched you over the years. Your ideas are from hell. Repent before you end up there. The white race ain't going to save you or anyone. You had nothing to do with being born white, and therefore have no claim. Well, my mom and daddy did. Other than through pridefulness, sinful, that you are more than another. I will fight the devil in you to my last breath. May that, in the light of God, set you free, Tom, from the hell you are in. You can be free from darkness, Tom. Repent now before you die and are alone forever in a burning hell. There you go with that burning you up in hell again stuff. Actually, the term was Gehenna, and Gehenna was simply a dump outside of Jerusalem where people dumped their trash. Suddenly the Italian, what was it, Dante got a hold of it, or whoever, and started writing all this mythical nursery rhyme crap about a hell. Jeez. Gotta watch those Italians. They get carried away. Well. After years of filling Democratic Party coffers with massive campaign donations, trial lawyers are cashing in their chips with a sweetheart deal from the government that will save the industry, billions of dollars over the next few years. Yeah, according to Legal Newsline report from the annual meeting of the American Association for Just Us, the nation's lobbying arm for the trial lawyers, the industry may get a tax break from the U.S. Treasury Department that would give trial lawyers the ability to write off expenses involved in contingency fee cases, much the same as businesses write off expenses. But unlike businesses, lawyers will benefit from the tax write-off in addition to the fee they charge the clients. They're trying to get the best of both worlds, said Christopher Apple, an attorney in the public policy group at the Washington-based law firm Shook, Hardy, and Bacon. Sounds like a sandwich. It's not really a business expense. It's a loan made to other person the attorney fully expects to get back. Congress shut down a similar provision in 2009 that would have given trial lawyers a tax break on contingency fee losses. So, I guess Obama is very happy, and the Democrats are very happy with the trial lawyers. And you've been in jail or anything like that, and been in court, you know about those trial lawyers. You sure ought to. Well, this is I'm going to play something for you. I think here I'm going to try about a boy dying after an exorcism ritual. This is a Russian boy suffocated to death in exorcism ritual. And that's where these religious fanatics get this stuff.
Framed photo and these toys are all that remain of 4-year-old Dima Lee, who, according to Russian state media, was killed in a bizarre exorcism ritual gone terribly wrong. Dima's mother, who did not want to show her face on camera, says the woman who performed the ritual was a local healer who had cured relatives of diabetes and other ailments.
Approach and ask, what is your name? Then she said, that is not true. That is not your name. Your name is Lucifer the Demon.
Dima's mother felt confident enough to leave her son with a woman at this house in the Sergeyevka village in eastern Russia. When they returned hours later, Dima was dead. He'd suffocated while healers allegedly held him face down on the ground. Alexei Ilyushov is a paramedic who was called to the scene.
They tried themselves to perform resuscitation on him, such as artificial ventilation, indirect heart massage. When nothing helped, they became terrified and called an ambulance.
Local authorities have launched a criminal investigation. Deborah Gambera, Reuters.
Well, you see, it's that way all over the world with these religious fanatics. This was clear over there in eastern Russia. Now, these people won't struggle and fight for their race, but they'll fall for this crazy-ass practices and actually even kill their children or deny them medical help. This is how crazy religion is. Well, the critics are questioning why Obama's administration doesn't crack down on sanctuary cities. Now, wait a minute. I've declared Indiana a lone wolf sanctuary state. So watch it. Now that Obama administration is suing Arizona over its tough immigration law, some critics are asking why so-called sanctuary cities are getting a pass for ignoring federal immigration law. There are more than 50 sanctuary cities in the U.S. supporters of such policies that say they want the local police to focus on solving crimes and leave the immigration work to the federal authorities. And, of course, these people know the federal authorities are not going to do anything. So that's funny. You know? What sanctuary cities are saying is we're not going to preempt the federal government. It's the federal government's responsibility, says Representative Louis Gutierrez, Democrat of Illinois. Well, that's obviously a con job because the federal government hasn't done anything for 40 years, really, about the problem. And so they're just saying, well, that's what we want. We don't want them to do anything. So they say, that's the federal government's responsibility. No, it's the responsibility of the states to take care of themselves, their own sovereignty. More and more states need to go pull back into their own sovereignty. That's what they need.
Less than a week after U.S. President Barack Obama gave his first major speech on immigration reform since taking office, the Justice Department filed a federal lawsuit against Arizona over the state's strict new immigration law. The law, aimed at trying to stem the flood of thousands of illegal immigrants who cross Arizona's border with Mexico each month, requires state and local police to investigate the immigration status of anyone they reasonably suspect of being an illegal immigrant. That requirement, the Justice Department argues, is unconstitutional and would sap law enforcement resources. The lawsuit asked for a preliminary and permanent injunction against the law, which is slated to take effect on July 29th. John Decker.
Now let me get this straight. The federal government takes our money, turns around and sues us because we want to be safe in our states and stay safe in our homes and safe in our communities. Now it's time to get rid of the federal government as far as I'm concerned. I see no advantage to the federal government anymore. Do you? What advantage is there? They take us into war, put us into debt. They back up the big transnational corporations. They back up big pharma. In other words, they're a tool in the hands of the super rich. Only charge the super rich about 15% taxes percentage. And so, actually, the federal government's trying to kill us. Destroy our country, kill us, replace us, and that's it. Screw them. You notice all of a sudden how this, what's his name, Chelsea guy from the, Ben Chelsea, I think it is, from the NAACP, something like that. Anyhow, this two-thirds white man who's leading the Negroes. You notice how they're stoking up all this attacking the teabaggers who are worthless anyhow. And they're going to fight back and forth. Well, don't you realize what this is? They want to get just muddy the hell out of the water so you're not thinking about more important things as the election comes towards us in November. They're going to get everybody all bogged down into pissy arguments, pissing matches, and so forth. keep your mind off the big issues. That's what they're doing. You wait and see. You know, like if there are any racists in the group of teabaggers I met, I don't know where in the hell they were at. Now, you see, the investigation has shown that the mines down there in West Virginia that killed 29 guys the last time, it's killed guys before that. They actually, it was a criminal deal. They turned off the gas monitors. Yeah, they turned off the gas monitors. Now, they're supposed to be wired up so that when the great big old chomper driller machine goes into these walls, that the sensor's right out on front. And the minute that sensor detects gases, it shuts down the whole engine. But the mine owners instructed them to wire around the thing. So that's, these people need to be charged and hung, or given the needle, or given the electric chair, or gassed. No doubt about it. They deliberately murdered 29 miners. And I'll bet you that they were probably all white. That's Massey Mining, I believe it is, down in West Virginia. Do you think that that wonderful Senator Byrd didn't know anything about all this bullshit and wasn't being paid off? All they want to do is talk about it. He'd been in the Klan. Well, more money needed for killing families around the world. Around the world. Not good enough. We spend more on our military than any other of the nations on Earth combined. All other nations. Pentagon warns, that's tantamount to threatens Congress, accounts running dry. The Pentagon said on Wednesday it may be forced to take extreme measures, like not paying salaries, if the Democratic-led Congress fails to pass the $37 billion war spending bill. They call it defense. It's not defense. It's war. When you're not attacked by an army from some other country and you attack them, that's war. A war bill. And they want them to do it right now before the August recess. As far as I'm concerned, turn it down. Don't give them a damn dime. Cut those 750 U.S. installations down, way down. Cut that war spending down at least half. Should be more than that, but at least half to get. That's a good start. And if you wonder why, well, why is you're broke and you're borrowing all that money to do that? It's all being borrowed. Mostly from the Chinese and the Indians and people like that. You're giving up your birthright. You're trading your birthright. And you're not even getting a bowl of porridge for it. Don't be stupid. And don't want to be one of these goddamn Republican flag wavers. Oh, we gotta give the military anything they want, man. Oh, well, because if we don't, well, everybody's going to invade us and kill us in our beds, man. As Smedley Butler, General Smedley Butler said, war is a racket. War spending called defense is a racket. Well, here's a nice email from a Russian comrade visiting the United States. Hey, Tom, I can't help sending this email now that I saw you on TV. I am a Russian in the U.S. here on business till August. I'm not really a fan of America for known reasons, but what I saw here makes me sympathize with you guys. Nowhere else in the world I saw a country with its core national values and idea generator population so severely depressed. In the whole world, the U.S. is never associated with Indians and Chinese, but this is what I see around here. I'm in a very successful Hudson River waterfront neighborhood near Manhattan. Add other parasite aliens everywhere else in the country. Surprisingly, my client's office is almost all white. But when I'm back at the hotel, it feels like I'm in the middle of a barbarian's nest with people speaking their barbarian languages that I don't understand, and with their alien mentality. I don't know whether they are on workers' visa or they're actually residents, but they are really set to live their lives in the U.S. and reproduce. What you guys did to your country over the last 50 years is ridiculous. You catch Mexican drug smugglers packed with Bolivian cocaine at the border, then you just send them back to Mexico without ever even severe prosecution. You developed unhealthy, perverted democratic morale and got stuck in it, as in shit. Now Indians and Latinos and homosexuals is what you got. I really wish you good luck dealing with those. Interestingly, this is something that happens with the Native Americans, and that time aliens were you. Only this time it's not going to be any good in this country at all. I guess I'm not a racist, but rather a nation's values defender. Indians and CO are humans too. They're born on this planet in their own territory, and they deserve living their lives, not disturbing others and not being disturbed, unless they spread. This kind of morality is definitely stronger than yours. Cheers. Well, I told him, thank you for your very correct thoughts. Good luck back in Russia. I wish the Russian whites and American whites strong solidarity. Well, I agree with some of that too, that it's tribalism, and people who are numerous in a particular territory in the world should stay there. People shouldn't bother them, shouldn't wage war against them, and vice versa. So, tribalism is something that's quite moral as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. Mr. Tom, I saw a program about the Nazi movement in America on the History Channel. It seems to me your organization is holding on to the past quite intensely, which is good, but maybe you should start thinking outside the insurgency word. Real bad word. I'm a soldier. All I fight are insurgents. But I believe in your, excuse me, our cause. I think outside the box. Instead of making the majority hate us, let's make them love us with our words. The Army teaches hearts and minds. Let's use this to our advantage. Most people think of the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and other terrorist groups as insurgents. Time to change the name of our cause to something a little less threatening. Also, tell your men to get in shape. Round is not a shape. Teach them only the strong will survive. Develop underground communities. Build on what we own, not on what we gain. The war is coming. I'm on your side. Yours truly, Joe. Well, I adopted the name insurgency because of what it means. It's opposed to the central government. It's opposed to the ruling class. It's very simple. And I can't put it any simpler. And the majority of the people should feel the same way, or should. But I don't think it's real good psychology to spend too much time directly trying to win over the crowd. I don't think the crowd, number one, thinks it knows what it wants, but it, in many cases, really doesn't know what it wants. So, and I don't think the 1% can be concerned about that too much. People have been trying what you're talking about for decades. Most of these other groups have spent all their time trying to be Mr. Nice Guy to the public, or convince them you're okay, but it hasn't done much good. So I think we need to declare what we are, and then go out and find the kind of people that understand what we are and want to be a part of it. Anyhow, that's my position, and we're not going to get rid of insurgency. Hey, Tom, in the movie Treasure of Sierra Madre, famous Alfonso, quote, "Badges? We don't need badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges. Now we need for the white race to become rebellious and lawless to make the Jew system break down faster. It may simply break down due to the mega debts anyway. Or it may break down due to sky-high gasoline or the younger generation being too dumb, too naive, too lazy to simply cope with any reality at all. Maybe you Americans are just way too fat to cope with the change to a harsh reality, i.e. those previous Walmart fat photos you sent me. But the above movie, The Treasure of Sierra Madre, is very realistic self-defense situation. Notice the guns and the willingness to use them were 100% absolutely necessary. Well, I like Viva Zapata better with Marlon Brando. And if you haven't watched that, I would suggest you give that a try. It's black and white. I'm trying to remember that famous director. Howard Hawks, I think, made that film. Now, don't forget to call in on our 574-267-5036 update line and leave your messages, leave your little news items and your little speeches. And if they're pretty good, I'll put them on the radio show and also on Wednesday night coming up next Wednesday at 9 o'clock. We're going to see if we can start off a call-in show where we'll take your calls on the telephone and we'll record them, the discussion, and then I'll put them on the radio, and we'll see how that goes. Next Wednesday, 9 o'clock. Hey, TT, I'm tired of sitting on my ass waiting for all hell to break loose. This invasion of America is driving me crazy. First, a little about myself. I'm a 45 years old, broke my neck last year falling down the stairs, so I can't fight nor can I shoot a gun due to a hand injury. I was blown up. I'm a sound engineer and love to work with bands. I'm a proud white man and proud of my race. I just want to help the cause. Is there anything I can do that will help you out with the cause? My fiance wants to help as well. Thank you for reading this. Please respond. I want help, man. Well, I see the University of Texas, the governing board voted unanimously this morning to rename a dormitory and park named after former leaders of the KKK. Will Washington, D.C. be renamed now because George Washington was a slave owner? It'll be interesting to see what happens.
Welcome to Democracy Now. What are you doing here in Haiti?
Well, we currently we're functioning as camp management for the Pecheville Club camp, or what they call his Jerendigal.
I don't know what the fuck I'm doing here, man.
55,000 IDP population in the camp, about 100 meters from here. And our job is to be principal coordinator of the other NGO actors in the camp and to advocate for the camp. And we also function as a medical NGO and have a Class 3 hospital on site. And now we're currently beginning a project of... we had done the first primary relocation, but I'm careful to talk about that because it's there's approximately 1.8 million displaced people, and to date there's been a total of 7,000 people relocated citywide. By relocations, we're talking about getting people out of spontaneous camps and into planned camps that have better security, better services, and so on, and that sort of thing. But,
can I ask you a question, Sean, while we're in this stinky tent here in Haiti? Did you do anything up there in East Tennessee where all those white people were out of houses and flooded and everything else? I didn't see your white ass up there at all. What do you got this thing for the niggers? And I haven't seen you going down to Chile either. They had a hell of an earthquake down there. Tore down things all over the place. Didn't see your ass down there. What's that all about, Sean?
Long term, the idea is to get people either into returns into neighborhoods, making those neighborhoods functional, giving them services, and or for those camps on the outside to become, instead of considered planned camps, really to be model communities, and for hopefully, you know.
Sean, don't you realize that's the way they've lived for hundreds of years? they lived in squalor and tents all along, unless somebody come along and build them a shack. Now, the guy in Canada wanted to give them thousands of these, or at least hundreds of these fiberglass cabins. And they got a whole bunch of them down there, and the people moved into them, then moved right out of them. They'd rather live on the ground than in an old tent, you know. What's that all about, Sean? I don't see anybody around this documentary you're doing any work except quiet people.
Business is manufacturing, jobs come into those areas, and you go from tents to temporary shelters, and then ultimately into housing, and hopefully into land ownership.
Land ownership? You gotta be kidding. It's always going to be a few people in those nigger countries going to control the whole show. You think you're going to get agrarian reform in Haiti and split the land up? You could split it all up into one-acre parcels for the whole damn bunch of them. And within a few months or a year or two, it'd be right back in the same hands that had it before. You know that, Sean. What do you say?
Brought you down here to begin with.
Well, it was a series of events in a certain amount of timing, but the earthquake had hit the news, and I had had a personal experience with one of my children having a surgery in that year and seeing just how important pain medications can be during surgery and hearing of the kind of Civil War-style medicine that was happening here. Because, you know, it was a poverty earthquake, and so you have the devastation.
Poverty earthquake? What you mean by that, Sean Penn? A poverty earthquake? I've never heard of a poverty earthquake. Yeah. Well, anyhow, that's enough of Sean Penn. I can't handle his ugly puss being... We all know how that works. The Jew producers are always looking for a good thing for publicity, for stars that maybe are not getting the best movie scripts anymore. Sean Penn, you get on down there to Haiti and they'll take your picture all over the place and you can have your picture taken carrying a little nigger baby around and things like that. Maybe picking up a little piece of trash and put it in the trash can. And believe me, you're going to get tons of publicity, man, and probably get a new movie.
The wrong dressing room. And I couldn't find any place to put my stuff. And I don't know how you are, but I need a place to put my stuff. So that's what I've been doing back there, just trying to find a place for my stuff. You know how important that is. That's the whole meaning of life, isn't it? Trying to find a place for your stuff. That's all your house is. Your house is just a place for your stuff. If you didn't have so much goddamn stuff, you wouldn't need a house. You could just walk around all the time. That's all your house is. It's a pile of stuff with a cover on it. You see that when you take off on an airplane and you look down and you see everybody's got a little pile of stuff. Everybody's got their own pile of stuff. And when you leave your stuff, you've got to lock it up. You don't want somebody to come by and take some of your stuff. They always take the good stuff. They don't bother with that crap you're saving. Ain't nobody interested in your fourth grade arithmetic papers. They're looking for the good stuff. That's all your house is. It's a place to keep your stuff while you go out and get more stuff. Now, sometimes you've got to move. You've got to get a bigger house. Why? Too much stuff. You've got to move all your stuff. And maybe put some of your stuff in storage. Imagine that. There's a whole industry based on keeping an eye on your stuff. Enough about your stuff. Let's talk about other people's stuff. Did you ever notice when you go to somebody else's house, you never quite feel 100% at home? You know why? No room for your stuff. Somebody else's stuff is all over the place. And what awful stuff it is. Where did they get this stuff? And if you have to stay overnight at someone's house, you know, unexpectedly, and they give you a little room to sleep in that they don't use that often. Someone died in it 11 years ago. And they haven't moved any of his stuff. Or wherever they give you to sleep, usually right near the bed, there's a dresser, and there's never any room on the dresser for your stuff.
someone else's shit is on the dresser. Have you noticed that their stuff is shit and your shit is stuff? Sometimes you go on vacation, you gotta bring some of your stuff with you. You can't bring all your stuff. Just the stuff you really like. The stuff that fits you well that month. Let's say you're gonna go to Honolulu. You're gonna go all the way to Honolulu. You gotta take two big bags of stuff. Plus your carry-on stuff, plus the stuff in your pockets. You go all the way to Honolulu and you get in your hotel room and you start to put away your stuff. That's the first thing you do in a hotel room is put away your stuff. I'll put some stuff in here, put some stuff in there. Here's another place, some stuff here. I'll put some stuff over there. You put your stuff over there, I'll put my stuff over here. Here's another place, some stuff. Hey, we got more places than we got stuff. We're gonna have to buy more stuff. You're thousands of miles from home and you don't quite feel at ease, but you know that you must be okay because you do have some of your stuff with you. And you relax in Honolulu on that basis. That's when your friend from Maui calls and says, hey, why don't you come over to Maui for the weekend? Spend a couple of nights over here. Oh, shit, no. Now what stuff do you bring? Right, you've got to bring an even smaller version of your stuff. Just enough stuff for a weekend on Maui. And you get over, and you're really spread out now. You've got shit all over the world. You've got stuff at home, stuff in storage, stuff in Honolulu, stuff in Maui, stuff in your pockets. Supply lines are getting longer and harder to maintain. But you get over to your friend's house in Maui, and they give you a little place to sleep in. There's a little window ledge or some kind of a small shelf, and there's not much room on it, but it's okay because you don't have much stuff now. And you put what stuff you do have up there. You put your imported French toenail clippers, your overeaters with the 45-day guarantee, your semi-flavored dental floss, and your Afrin 12-hour decongestant nasal spray. And you know you're a long way from home, and you know that you must be okay because you do have your Afrin 12-hour decongestant nasal spray. And you relax in Maui on that basis. That's when your friend says, hey, I think tonight we'll go over the other side of the island and stay at my friend's house overnight. Oh, shit. No! Now you just bring the things you know you're going to need. Money, keys, comb, wallet, lighter, hanky, pen, cigarettes, contraceptives, Vaseline, whips, chains, whistles, bugles, and a book.
Well, life wouldn't be any fun without George Carlin. Good thing you got it all on tape and on audio and in books. Yeah. Isn't that true about stuff? Getting a bigger house because you got too much stuff? Everybody complains about that. Too much stuff. Sometimes I get so much stuff, I put stuff outside in the front yard by the road where the big sign says free. So they can take my stuff away. Well, here's an interesting little piece. It has to do with world hunger. And I wonder if the big boys tried to experiment around with a little bit of let's cut the population and cut it drastically and by playing with the food market. Now, we all know we got too many people and something's got to be done. But let's listen to this and see what you think, okay? All right, let's get my equipment all ready to go here. Now, these are liberal types that are going to be read between the lines, if you will. All
right. Last night, Louise and I were flying home from Washington, D.C. Here I am on 5 hours sleep, if I sound semi-coherent. But in any case, I'm reading this issue of Harper's. I'm reading this article, the cover story, the food bubble, how Wall Street starved millions and got away with it. And I want to share with you just a couple of sentences. Fred Kaufman wrote this thing that just totally blew my mind. And I'm sitting here sharing this with Louise. First of all, it opens, the history of food took an ominous turn in 1991 at a time when no one was paying much attention. That was the year that Goldman Sachs decided our daily bread might make an excellent investment. Then toward the end of the story, here, just a couple of sentences here. Bankers had taken control of the world's food. Money chased money, and a billion people went hungry. Remember the food riots of a couple of years ago around the world? The worldwide price of food had risen by 80% between 2005 and 2008. And unlike other food catastrophes of the past half century or so, the United States was not insulated from this one. Could it be because it was our banksters who were doing it? As 49 million Americans found themselves unable to put a full meal on the table. One in five kids came to depend on food kitchens. In Los Angeles, nearly a million people went hungry. In Detroit, armed guards had to watch over grocery stores. And then the question, could this happen again? And I came back and I shared this story with Sean, our executive producer, and said, we've got to cover this. This is a BFD, as Joe Biden would say. And so Frederick Kaufman, the contributing editor to Harper's Magazine, author of this month's cover story, which is just absolutely remarkable, The Food Bubble, How Wall Street Starved Millions and Got Away With It. He's also the author of several books, including A Short History of the American Stomach. You can check out the new article over at harpers.org. Frederick, welcome to the program, first of all.
Thank you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. We did contact Goldman Sachs, invited them to come on this program. They explicitly said, no thank you. Stephen Strongin, the head of Global Investment Research, has written a letter in response to your article, and that letter stands. And so I'm going to toss a couple pieces of that to you. But first, Frederick, give us a summary. I've shared a few words from your article, but give us the big picture here on your article.
Well, I think we can all remember that back in 2008, the price that we paid for our weekly groceries went way up, that milk went up and eggs went up and the price of hamburger meat went up. And
yeah, I remember that. Do you remember that, boys and girls? Yeah. Really got a little hairy there for a while.
What was behind this unbelievable rise in the price of food? And that's what I went to find out about a year ago. And what I discovered was that there is an incredible pressure being put on the price of food, not actually from any issue in the food supply. And one of the things we have to get clear right from the start, whenever we talk about the issues of global hunger, whenever we talk about the issues of food price, we have to remember that there is enough food in the world to feed double the population. There is.
Oh, well, we're not screwing enough. Come on, get to screwing. There's twice the amount of food that's needed, so that means we can screw another and double the population. How about that?
No crisis. There is no shortage in the amount of food. So therefore, what drives people to hunger? And in 2008, what drove 250 million more people into the hunger, bringing the world figure to over a billion? What did it? It's the price of food. It's when the food price goes up and up and up. That's when people starve, because in this country, we might find it inconvenient to spend $5, $6, $7 for a dozen eggs. But in another country where you're spending 80% of your income each day on food, those kinds of price increases drive you into famine. And so what I discovered was a new kind of investment that really hit full stride right around the time that the food prices went up, and that was the commodity index fund. And so that's what I wrote about in Harper's, about how Wall Street was actually behind this outrageous statistic of more than a billion hungry people on Earth.
It's absolutely amazing, Frederick. And we're talking with Frederick Kaufman, Fred Kaufman, who wrote the cover article, the current issue of Harper's. And you got to read this thing. We saw Wall Street, after the Commodities Futures Modernization Act was passed, Phil Graham's brilliant little piece of legislation that Bill Clinton enthusiastically signed off on in 99, as I recall, maybe it was 2000, that it allowed them to turn money into a commodity. In fact, not even the money, but bets on bets on bets on the promise of money into a commodity that could be bought and sold. And so we have $600 trillion worth of derivatives out there right now, according to the Bank of International Settlements, which, you know, compared to the $65 trillion world GDP. And back in the 90s, and I'm wondering, was this a part of the deregulation of the Reagan-Bush era or what? The banks decided that they would make some money off, you know, corn and hog bellies and soybeans, things that traditionally were traded between buyers and sellers as a way of hedging their bets, you know, that actually stabilized the market. And when the banksters got in, they just, as you point out in the article, everybody was just buying long. In other words, they were screwing up the market, but they made a hell of a lot of money doing it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right on all points there, Tom. And I think one of the things that we have to get over when we discuss the food bubble and we discuss what happened in agricultural markets is everybody's eyes just glaze over and their brains turn off when we start talking about wheat futures or corn futures. And I was the same way until I realized that it's precisely that turn off, it's precisely that glazing of the eyes, which the bankers are exploiting to their own advantage. The fact that we don't understand, most people don't understand it, the fact that they are able to manipulate it in their own particular way, and this is what I discovered. So that's the first thing we have to keep in mind, is that we actually can understand this, that when people talk about longs and shorts, those are not the most difficult ideas
right.
in the world.
And, the second thing, Fred, we just have half a minute left
here. And the second thing is that you're absolutely right about deregulation. This starts in the Reagan years. It's a 20-year process. And you're also right about stabilization, which is that the bankers have a stake in destabilized grain markets. I mean, that's
right.
The real outrage here, is that they are seeking to destabilize markets so that they can profit on rising prices, except they've forgotten that there is reality and there is fiction. And their fiction might be a beautiful mathematical formula that they can get rich on, but the reality is people need food to eat.
Right. The more they destabilize markets, the more they make money off that instability, whether it's food markets or whether it's money markets, you know, cash markets. It's just absolutely incredible. The bankers responsible for a billion hungry people, 49 million in the United States. Fred Kaufman, pick up the current copy of Harper's. Harper's.org, you can check it out. But buy the copy in the newsstand. It's amazing. Fred, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Now, you see how that affected us a few years ago. And, of course, the reason is because we're buying more and more food from every place else in the world, bringing it in from Mexico and Central America and South America and all over the world. And we used to, we used to grow, 90%, 95% of our own food here in this country. Some things we can't raise here too well, but some of the stuff we bring in here we don't even need, you know what I mean? I was raised on a farm. It was meat and potatoes, boy, and maters from the garden, and watermelons and muskmelons, stuff like that. You didn't have as wide a selection, but we did fine. So you see, now we are even more third world. So it was the point where they could manipulate things in the third world, and we wouldn't know too much about it. Or at least didn't pay any attention to it. But now that we're so directly linked with hundreds and hundreds of trucks coming in every day from south of the border with food that's grown outside this country, when Goldman and Sachs and these Jews and these people play with these markets, well, we could have mass starvation, not just in the third world, but in the United States. So that's why you got to cover all the bases here, because this is all tied to the banksters and the transnational corporations, and those are the people that most of the politicians cater to. So we got a job cut out for us, and here, don't go down there voting for these damn Republicans, because they're really into it up to their neck, and the big shot Democrats too. So anyhow, I hope you understand what we're putting out there, man. If you don't listen, you'll have to feel. Now, I told you earlier about how these mine owners are lying through their teeth and committing criminal acts that caused maybe 29 miners to die. And the same thing the big oil companies do all the time. And this is definitely an issue for the white race, white working people. Now, here is a contractor down on the Gulf that got fired for a reporter taking pictures down there. And you see, BP and these big corporations have a veritable army. You just have that stuff in the mines all the time. They had their own private police forces, and they could get away with anything they want. So let's listen to this guy talk. He's blowing the whistle.
In June, a WDSU news photographer and I were blocked from talking to cleanup workers and getting within 100 yards of them. One of the people we ran into on the beach that day has since been fired by BP. Now he's telling all. It's a story you'll only see on 6.
Meet Adam Dillon.
I'll talk to you when you put the camera down.
He wasn't talking then, but he is now.
Why did you want to talk to me tonight?
Because of what I told you on Grand Isle that day. When you met me and you were straight with me and I saw the way that you were being treated, I told you that I wish I could tell you more. And after the way BP treated me, I'm telling you now that you deserve an answer, and that's why you're getting an answer.
Shortly after our beach run-in, Dillon was promoted to a position at the BP Command Center in Houma.
I eventually just became a liability to their operations up there because of the information that I found out.
Dillon says he was fired because he was seen as a threat to his superiors.
Does BP have anything to hide? A lot of people have made that claim. Have you seen anything to make you believe that there's something other than the cleanup effort going on here?
I saw something when I was out there. I took pictures of something, and I brought it to the attention of the command structure, and whatever I took pictures of, 12 hours later, I was gone.
He believes those photos showed equations relating to the use of dispersant on the oil in the Gulf. But while Dillon has harsh words for those in charge and questions how they're handling the cleanup operation, he's just as quick to credit the thousands of people doing all they can to undo the damage to our shores.
After working in that command center, and I worked with some really great people. There are some very, very great, hard-working individuals in there. But the bottom line is just about money. And there are some very cutthroat individuals, and they're not worried about cleaning up that spill as it is.
Now the former Army Special Ops soldier says he's lost all faith in BP.
I will never have loyalty to this company. I will always have loyalty to my country, and my country comes first. And what this company is doing to this country right now is just wrong.
Once this evening from BP and the Unified Command, but were unsuccessful. Those we did reach said they were unable to comment on the matter. We will continue to reach out to those in charge. And Monday on WDSU, unsuccessful. Those we did reach said they were unable to comment on the matter. We will continue to reach out to those in charge. And Monday on WDSU News at 10, we'll have more from my interview with Adam Dillon, his account of an incident in which he tells me he was confined and interrogated for almost an hour.
Well, we're going to close out with an old song from the Fugs, way back in anti-war days, called Kill for Peace. I'm not sure what year, but evidently the guy who... Kupferberg, founder of the folk rock satirist The Fugs, died yesterday at 86. But anyhow, this is sort of a funny song, sort of a black type funny, you know what I mean?
Like that.
There you go. Thule Kupferberg, founder of the folk rock satirist The Fugs, F-U-G-S, who died. Anyhow, he wrote some books, too. 1001 Ways to Beat the Draft, 1001 Ways to Live Without Working, and pardon my French here, but he wrote a book called Teach Yourself Fucking and Rest in Peace. Well, that's it for today, boys and girls. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll have a surprise guest on tomorrow. I'm not going to introduce guests anymore because they move around so much, and then they call in and say, well, we can't do it today, we got to do it next week, and we got to do it tomorrow, we got to do it yesterday, and like that. So I'm just going to say we're supposed to have a guest on the show tomorrow, Freya's Day. How about that? 14-5, and we'll see you and watch that fucking. I mean, what? 14-5.